CliffCentral.com.
Okay, Ozzy Osbourne, a little paranoid for you on a Thursday. Oh, we almost went into another song. Hey, Canthan, what's happening, man?
Oh, the usual, looting, pillaging, sacking major cities.
Oh, good. Yeah. No, all good. I actually wanted to just start off the burning platform this morning by referring to somebody who I used to follow on social media quite regularly, and he was somebody who made, I thought, a very valuable and interesting contribution to Twitter in South Africa, which, trust me, is a hard thing to do because it's like adding... let me think about it carefully. It's like adding a vaccine to a swamp. And the vaccine could cure people of stupid, but the swamp is so dirty that the minute you drop the vaccine into the swamp, it just gets subsumed into the ugliness. I'm talking about someone called Soulnomics, who was on Twitter for a while in South Africa and made a quite valuable contribution to discussions around society and the economy and a bunch of other things. And Canthan told me last week that he'd actually died. And he'd committed suicide, and that's very, very sad when we lose people who I think can make things a little bit better by helping the rest of us to think. And we know social media is such a toxic place that if you are the sort of person who is going through something and you're not entirely capable of handling it on your own or even with some help sometimes, whether it's from doctors, family, friends, medicine, whatever it might be, and then social media adds to the weight of what you're already bearing. For some people, it is unbearable. And he took his own life. I mean, you knew the guy?
I knew him very well. Ended up meeting him fairly early. I think it was around about December of 2018 that I first made contact with him.
Mm.
And then went down to meet him. And he was out in the Midlands, in the Natal Midlands, before moving up to... Johannesburg earlier this year.
Yeah, you told me about him on Thursday. Now, obviously, with the name Soulnomics on Twitter, he was a fan of Thomas Sowell, who's a well-known economist and scientist and theorist in California.
Yes.
He's an academic of great international repute.
Yes, and massive following around the world and really insightful thinker. And this youngster, and because he was young, he was 29 years old when I met him, and absolutely brilliant mind.
Was he not also outed on social media?
Look, I think that there were attempts to out him on social media, which fizzled out very quickly. But obviously, I didn't want to go into details around who he actually was because, you know, of his family and all of that kind of stuff, because this is an intensely personal thing for
sure.
People to have to deal with. And they
When was the last time you spoke to him?
On the late December last year when all of this stuff was going down with the NCA and he was really concerned and he was saying, hey, are you okay? And...
Ironically, he wasn't.
Yeah, but you know that is the case with strong people. Really, most of the time, that whatever pain they're actually carrying, they tend to not really share it in public because, certainly I do that. You know, you'll never hear me. Just about everyone who asks me how you're doing, and I'll always say I'm fabulous. But. Sometimes
you're not.
Well, sometimes you're not. But most of us develop ways of dealing with this stuff over time. But it's a tremendous loss. Look, I was really fond of him. He was what my Jewish friends would refer to as a mensch. I can't really put it any plainer than that. But like I said, brilliant mind and just...
He's in his 20s?
Well, he was 30 this year. So he was 29 when I met him.
It's a horrible, it's such an injunction on all of us to enjoy every day.
But
make our contribution where we can. And
more wisdom than people double his age, I'll say.
Yeah,
certainly.
Sure. Very sad loss. Okay. I wanted to just reflect on that because, you know, sometimes even if people are not known and famous and we don't know who they actually are, they can still... make a vital contribution to debates online, try to bring in fact rather than just outrage, and let's at least herald this guy for what he did. Okay, couple of things to talk about, Canthan. The Burning Platform, as always, brought to you by Nando's. Some weeks it is very, very hot. Some weeks it is Mozambican spice. Some weeks it is lemon and herb. It's just there's this malaise in government at the moment. No one's doing anything. The state capture inquiry rolls on like a train with absolutely no destination.
Well, I think this week we've got the particular issue that everyone is setting up in Davos, in Switzerland.
And we're not.
Say that again?
We're not. South Africa is hardly represented there.
Well, we've got a full contingent out there.
Have we?
Yes.
Because I was on social media yesterday, and I read something from Magnus Haystack, which is actually a quote from Bruce Whitfield, saying it's kind of depressing for South Africa in Davos right now.
Well, Tito's up there. They're on a bit of a charm offensive up there.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, to try
This is good news, so tell me more.
Well, they're trying to basically persuade people that this is, it's the old refrain from Ramaphosa that, you know, South Africa's open for business and... We're actually putting our house in order. Some of the things that they've been putting on the table out there is that they're actually trying to put in place the processes. So one of the things that they've said is, well, we're actually opening up the economy because we're now going to be freeing up the spectrum for additional mobile coverage. They've also spoken about the fact that SAA has been put under business rescue. They've spoken about the fact that Eskom is now going to be brought under control, purportedly. And so that's essentially the spiel that's going down out there. The reception has been kind of muted, you know, and generally I think if you use the rand-dollar exchange rate as a indicator of where things are actually going, there hasn't really been any movement that we can speak of. So I think that it's not bad, but at the same time, everyone, I guess, is kind of like, well, meh, let's see what happens.
Okay, so that's our contingent at Davos, but why did you bring it up as the issue everyone's talking about this week?
No, I didn't bring it up as the issue everyone's talking about. It just so happens that, you know, we're wondering where government is and what they're not doing, and the truth is that they're actually outside of the country.
Okay, so the whole lot of them. Is Cyril there as well?
Yeah, I believe he is. I haven't actually... checked in the past couple of days, but
all right. Well,
but he should be.
While he's there, I just saw an update from Outer, who occasionally put up some interesting stuff, saying this morning that apparently Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma, this is as reported by The Citizen, who is a minister in some department, we're not sure, in the presidency or something, but yes. She occasionally will open her mouth and say something. She said this week that municipalities need more money for maintenance. Local government funding model is not working, the Minister of Cooperative Governance says. And then Arta's response is perhaps they don't need more money, but rather need to manage what money they have better.
Well, the truth is that we actually need fewer municipalities. So that would be a starting point. Because right now, what ends up happening is you have these really small municipalities which don't have the ability to actually pay the salaries of all of the councillors and at the same time be able to provide the services. So really the truth of the matter is that you need to amalgamate them. And I'm just checking, by the way, that the statement from the presidency office says that Ramaphosa has decided to give attention to pressing domestic priorities and won't be there.
Okay, so yeah. He's not going to.
So he's not there. But certainly I know that Tito has been there and he has been tweeting the stuff that he has been saying out there. But again, yeah. Tito has been kind of in trouble because, you know, the ANC has been trying to give him a smackdown around stuff that he's been talking about the Reserve Bank. And Tito, on the other hand, has come out with guns blazing and telling people to stop the Stalinist approach to muzzling speech.
Yeah, it's making him very unpopular in the state capture quarter of the ANC.
Yes, but at the same time, I think it's increasing his popularity with South Africans in general.
Well, what do you think is the end game here for Tito? Because he is taking some quite bold and brave steps, and he's got to table a budget in a month or so from now.
Yes.
Which is also going to be unpopular.
I think the interesting thing about Tito is that there's nothing that you can actually offer him right now that would actually swindle him into going down the path of state capture. Because if you look in terms of the way in which the guy lives his life right now, he lives a relatively simple life. You know, he loves going back to
Machubas Kloof.
Yes, and he does his own cooking, and you know, he loves just kicking back with a glass of whiskey, and he's basically very grounded. So if you go to someone like that who doesn't really need you know, a few million more in his bank account, because you know, what's he going to do with it? So really,
are you saying he's virtually, by ANC standards, incorruptible?
Well, by the ANC standards, yeah, absolutely.
And by ANC standards, it's a very low standard. We're not throwing throwing around assertions that this man might be the only ever human altruist and most virtuous person that ever lived.
But you know, he also, I suspect he's the type of person who actually does put in place long-term thinking. Remember that he was trained by Goldman Sachs.
Yes.
As was Maria Ramos. And there's a particular mindset that will come from having worked in that environment in terms of, you know, long-term investing, how do you build value? And if you then apply those skills to how one runs the country, I think that Tito's probably taking that particular view. So in other words, when the state capture crowd in the ANC turn around and try to give him a smackdown, he'll say, well, you know, I don't have to listen to you jokers. And okay. the truth is, right now, he is in a position of relative power, because the last thing that the ANC would need at this point is to have him recalled as finance minister, because that's the point at which the markets are going to turn around and throw up their arms and say, all right, that's it, we are out of here.
We give up on you, yeah. Losers.
Yeah. In other news, Moody's has downgraded the land bank.
I saw that. Yes. What does that mean in real terms?
Well, it basically means that if the land bank tries to borrow money from anywhere around the world, people basically say, now come back to us when Moody's actually decides that you are worth lending money to.
Okay. All right. While we're talking about land, I sometimes like to hear from people on the extreme left and the extreme right, and sometimes people in the middle, about what they really think of this land question. It's come up a couple of times on the show, and it's more emotive than it is factual. We know that the Institute of Race Relations, who are sometimes embroiled in controversies of their own, from the point of view of, like, they run the DA secretly and lots of other things. For which we
I wish they would run the DA secretly, because the DA would actually be...
It would work.
Yeah, it would be based on data rather than feelings.
Now, they're a think tank. They've published a number of surveys that show that actually...
I've got to say something about the Institute of Race Relations. The Institute of Race Relations has been consistent for the entire time that they've been in existence. So during the apartheid era, they gave exactly the same type of grief to the apartheid government as they are giving the ANC, and it's based on exactly the same thing. It's all about the data that they collect, and everything that they put forward is based on real research. And yeah, essentially they are a liberal think tank, and that's their job. It's to actually try and persuade as many people as possible that this is the particular path that you should be taking. But they came down in exactly the same way as they are doing right now on everyone during the apartheid era.
In other words, the government, even though the government has changed, has always hated them.
Yes.
And that's usually the mark of someone you should listen
Absolutely.
To.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. I watched an interesting documentary just yesterday on the Operation Vula.
Oh, yeah.
It was a movie made locally, and it was really interesting about...
Oh, someone made a movie of it.
Well, it's a short documentary stroke movie, and it involves all the characters. You know, Ronnie Kasrils and Mac Maharaj feature quite prominently. Also, Spiwe Nyanda, and they discuss how that communication setup was made in London, Lusaka, and South Africa, and how various ANC cadres would communicate with each other across vast distances at the very beginning of internet connectivity, and the way they would use telecom phone cards at public call boxes and that kind of thing. It was very interesting to watch. So I saw that, and I also stumbled across this. Maybe Facebook is starting to read algorithms that are slightly different for me, but I found a Feiteblad, or a fact sheet, from Ernst Roots of the of AfriForum.
Mm-hmm.
About land. I thought this might be interesting. Let's just take a listen to this.
Die Australiese minister van binnelandse sake, Peter Dutton, het opgemerk dat wit boere in Suid-Afrika geteiken word en dat die Australiese regering die proses moet versnel om visums aan wit Suid-Afrikaanse boere uit te reik.
Now that's
land gons. Die opmerking word natuurlik gemaak.
That's not news.
So did Peter Dutton really say that?
Yeah, that was, but that was a while ago. That was back in 2018. And it did launch for South Africans quite a lot of noise in political circles because suddenly people were saying, oh, well, international governments shouldn't have, and international governments that are not particularly involved in South Africa should not have comments about what's going on here. Now, Ernst, obviously, this is an old clip that's been circulating again, but there are interesting things going on in the land discussion. And I see just recently there have been talks about reporting Cyril to the UN for not adequately paying attention to farm murders in South Africa. It comes up over and over again on the internet. Are these things to be taken seriously?
Look, if you look at there are two things that we need to deal with. Firstly, there's the whole white genocide narrative, and then on the other hand, there's the question of farm murders. Now, is it true that as a group, farmers are actually under greater threat than other groups that you could think of, like doctors or lawyers? Pity about the lawyers, though. But
yeah, I don't think anyone would be complaining to the UN.
But the
UN would reject lawyer deaths.
You see, the fascinating thing about farm murders, though, is that it's not confined to white farmers. Mm. It's farmers.
Yeah.
So black farmers have been under attack as well. And you think of the logistics in terms of why farm murders actually become the issue that they are, because farms are massive, you know. So the ability for help to arrive from surrounding places in a short space of time is
difficult.
Because
they're outlying areas, it's rural, there's not enough policing.
Exactly.
We have a lot of violence, obviously, as an undercurrent in this country too. So I think it's worth reflecting on. It shouldn't be ignored as if it's a non-issue, but it should also be seen in context.
Yes, but what is also true is that the funding that used to go... What did they used to call those units, Gareth?
I can't remember, but yeah. there were special policing units who used to...
Yeah, but there was funding that effectively went into the farming communities that would then allow them to actually have trained personnel who would be...
And then in this ugly milieu of factors, we have to consider the fact that Becky Cele just last week said that people... private firearm ownership is something that he's against, and he thinks that private firearm ownership for self-defense should be something that should be left to the police.
Well, I think that he is of the view that the only people that should have firearms are criminals.
Well,
because that's really the scenario. That's the inevitable consequence of what actually goes down. If you consider how much violence that takes place in this country right now resulting from guns is actually committed by legal firearm owners. Nearly all of the legal firearm owners who perpetrate that violence are members of the police. No, really. I mean, you look in terms of, you know, domestic violence as an example, you know,
yeah.
Police personnel who kill their spouses as an example.
Themselves eventually.
And themselves eventually. But, you know, licensed gun owners, you know, people from Gun Owners South Africa. And
yeah, these are very law-abiding citizens.
They're law-abiding. They're trained. They're responsible.
It's like in Virginia, in America, and I know we're bouncing around quite a lot here, but they had a massive public demonstration at the Virginia State House against a move by the governor, Ralph Northam, who's the one who painted himself with blackface. Remember? Anyway, he's the one who's Ralph Northam.
But, you know, I think that people should paint themselves blackface, yellowface, whatever they
want to. Well, he's the one who got away with that because he's a Democrat. If he was a Republican, he would have been forced out of office. But the fact is that he tried to curb people's legal firearm ownership and Second Amendment rights in the state of Virginia. There was this huge demonstration of people. People came with all kinds of guns, and there was not one incident of violence. Not one. Nothing bad happened. Legal firearm owners are some of the most responsible people you will ever meet, because you have to jump through, in this country, so many hoops. I know I've got firearm licenses that have expired. There's this moratorium until March. I have to go and sort that out. But I will, like any other good firearm owner in the country who wants to comply with the law. You do what you have to. and they don't make it easy for you. But because you're a law-abiding citizen, you make sure that you tick the boxes. That's not true for criminals. It's not true for the police. And therefore, the likelihood of a legal firearm owner just running around willy-nilly using their gun for nefarious purposes is pretty negligible.
I wonder when Bekele is actually going to give up his armed escort that follow him all over the place.
Yeah, which we're paying for. All right, but just quickly, we are jumping around. I do apologize for this, but this happens when you're talking about current affairs. Anthea Gardner, who regularly gives us market commentary and all the rest, is watching what's happening at the World Economic Forum. She sent this clip of Richard Quest on CNN and then also on ENCA talking about what's going on in South Africa, and you might want to hear what his comments are on how people feel about South Africa this week. This is in reference to Tito Mboweni and Anthea's Twitter feed this morning.
A country like ours wanted to come here and say, guys, can you bring some money back home? They lured investors. How successful do you think that mission is?
Oh, I think it's highly unsuccessful.
Why?
Because if you haven't got the policies that investors want, if you haven't got the environment that is conducive to the investment, if there are problems within the country, and this is not about South Africa, this is anywhere, investors aren't going to come. Merely dressing it up in a nice box with a big bow and saying, hey, we're from X, we're nice people, come and visit us, will not work. Will not work. You have to have the background. You have to have the depth. You have to have the markets.
Well, that's interesting because that's Richard Quest just commenting to an ENCA journalist about how you can't just dress it up in a bow. No one's going to invest just because they like you. You've got to have the policies in place and the framework that gives people confidence in your country. Not rocket science.
No, it isn't. And but look, I think if anything, let's just say that what Mboweni is trying to do, being up there right now, is to not necessarily persuade people that they need to be believing him and rushing to invest, but really rather to kind of try and calm the waters until the budget speech, you know, which we touched on a couple of weeks ago, where I said that the most critical thing that's going to come out of this is going to be how he actually handles the budget speech.
Well, on the matter of the budget speech, I see that the Rational Standard has published an article on the NHI. Their article says it's built on a foundation of deceit. And you can go and read that at rationalstandard.com. But they've said, and here's a quote that was taken out, nowhere is the SEIA's intellectual dishonesty more evident than in how it assesses the affordability of the NHI. Government has been sketchy on exactly how much the NHI will cost the beleaguered taxpayer. In fact, they haven't even given us a number.
Well, fundamentally, the issue is going to be, where does Tito find money in the budget to fund the NHI? And he doesn't have any wriggle room whatsoever. He's playing this game of chicken right now with SAA, because, you know, SAA wants this $2 billion bailout, and Tito's not budging. You know, he's basically sitting up in Davos right now, and the money's not flowing. And SAA, in the meanwhile, is scaling back on its local flight operations, which is a good thing, because there are way too many flights that are currently running based on available capacity. But if he can't find $2 billion to actually fund the to fund SAA, where is he actually going to find the close to $200 billion that, by conservative estimates, would be needed to fund the NHI?
So the till is empty.
The till is completely empty, unless he actually look. Clearly, one of the things that Zweli Mkhize has in mind is to try and capture money that we currently spend on private medical aid,
yeah,
to steer in that direction. And that's not going to go down well at all.
Well,
because he can't really force an additional tax upon people based on what we currently pay for medical aid.
And all that will happen is that people will stop with, if he manages to get, if Zweli Mkhize manages to get his hands on, and let's say that through unbelievable processes they managed to force and squeeze money out of private healthcare into public healthcare, then all that's going to happen is those people who are currently paying for private healthcare will stop and will find international options, perhaps, or other things. They will take their money out of that system, so that will dry up too. People don't seem to understand that the free flow of capital is a genie that's out of the bottle.
I think I mentioned previously as well that there's a group of South African investors who are setting up a let's just say it's a very high-end hospital facilities in Gaborone.
Oh, right.
Yes.
And, that's clever.
Yeah, and the whole idea is that...
You'd hop in the car, you'd drive over the border, you'd get your medical care.
Well, in fact, the whole idea is that if you're part of the target market, they just basically airlift you and take you off there. And yes, Botswana tends to not actually meddle in things that actually work from the market point of view.
All right. There's some other talking points, and you can always give us your suggestions. If you'd like to hear Canton's thoughts and you'd like to suggest something that you want to add to the conversation, on 0797482090. This message is not going to go away, so I'm going to get to it. Canton, please tell us what is exactly going on in Russia. That's from Khucho.
We touched on that at length last week.
That it's basically Vladimir Putin shuffling cards in his cabinet and shuffling the prime ministership and presidency around so that he can maintain power.
I think
and it's, the illusion of democracy.
Well, I think it's a bit more, you know, kind of it's not really as simple as that. Look, certainly the fact that he's going to that he's wanting to retain power for the foreseeable future is part of that equation. But he already has a mechanism to do that because he's done it previously. Because previously he served his two terms, then stepped down as president and became prime minister, but he was effectively running the country as prime minister. And now that he's president, and again he's coming to the end of his term, he could go through the same process again. But I think he's in fact trying to just redraw the constitutional framework of Russia so that he doesn't have to step down. I would think that that would be the first piece of the puzzle that that he's trying to solve.
It's also worth reflecting how popular he is in Russia at the moment.
He's hugely popular. Look,
Everybody outside of Russia is saying it's not a very democratic country. It's an oligarchy. It's been run like a cash register for certain well-connected families, and everyone else suffers, and it's really not a great place. You don't see huge immigration into Russia. Nobody's desperate to get in. Its economy is in really the doldrums. It's not really going anywhere.
Well, you'd have to learn a language that sounds like a speech defect.
But the people inside Russia are loving it.
Well, by and large, because their levels of prosperity have actually increased dramatically during Putin's reign.
Coming off a very low base, let's just say.
Well, it was coming off the base of communism. But if you consider this, that, look, I've no doubt that Putin actually rigs elections. But is he able to rig elections to the level where he ends up with the 70 to 80% of the poll that he does right now? No. You know, so even if you consider that he's rigged it by 25%, he's still pulling a majority.
And he's extremely popular with young people above all.
Very much so.
So that's interesting because it's not people hankering for a past that they actually experienced. It's young people hankering for a past that's been fabricated in their heads and that they still think he's the guy to bring. Right?
Sure.
Okay, so that I hope, Khucho, we've answered your question for Canton this morning. There are a few things that are going on. We can go back to Davos if you don't mind for a minute. I watched the whole 18 minutes or even more of Donald Trump's speech at the World Economic Forum, which was interesting, and I mentioned it this morning in the opening remarks of the show because I think for a lot of people who don't or do like Trump, and really who cares whether you do or don't, or who cares whether I do or don't, it's immaterial how we feel about Donald Trump. The opening comments by Klaus, I can never remember his surname, the head of the World Economic Forum, if you could just check that for me, see, I want at least give the guy credit. He makes the point that the American economy is just booming at the moment. It is extraordinarily successful. Things are going very... Klaus Schwab is his name, correct. And things are just looking peachy for Americans right now. Donald Trump managed to do two big trade deals last week, which have been underreported in the media because the media don't generally like reporting anything good about Donald Trump. And impeachment, which is going on simultaneously, is like a sideshow to most Americans. There's terribly low level of interest in the impeachment. There's much more interest in what's going on for the average American, which is unprecedented levels of unemployment, job creation, wage improvements for everybody, including and most specifically the middle class and the working class. Some interesting facts in terms of just the numbers. And whether or not you like Donald Trump, it's worth watching that speech just to get a grip on what's going on in economics in America and what that has in terms of implications for the rest of us in the world. So go and take a look at it, even if it's not to your liking, because you don't want to hear him being braggadocious and talking about how well he's done and how well America's doing. Maybe you hate America, but it's still worth looking at because the numbers are not lying.
The numbers are actually looking brilliant. And what's interesting is that if you look in terms of people who were actually canvassed at Davos, a majority of them have been saying they'd actually prefer Donald Trump being in place for a subsequent term, simply because, you know, there was a lot of skepticism when he first pitched up at Davos.
Well, he's unpredictable in terms of where, sure of stability.
But if they look at purely in terms of his economic policies and the way in which he's been managing the U.S. Engagement with the rest of the world, which ultimately translates to the U.S. economy, there's been consistency there. You know, with S&P 500 at the highest levels ever in its history. So from an investment point of view for people around the world, he's been really, really good for business.
Apparently, 1/4 of all foreign direct investment last year was in just the first quarter of the year was American. In other words, that money from all over the world was flowing into America, 1/4 of all that money directly in.
Exactly, because if you consider the just simply if you were investing your money in the S&P 500 over the period of Donald Trump's presidency, the figures were way in double digits that you would have actually increased your value, which you know, from any point of view is astonishing. Whereas if you had stuck the money into investments on the JSE, well. Yes, yeah. Never mind. That's
well, we'll leave that alone for the moment. But it's worth having a look at. So don't be one of those people who says, I love Donald Trump or I hate Donald Trump without looking at the numbers. It doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what you feel. It's more important that you know. And on that note, there are probably some other stories that we could cover internationally. I know a lot of people talking about an expanded U.S. travel ban. Now, you said something interesting to me once. You said you've never been racially profiled under the Trump administration, but you were under the Obama administration.
Yes, 7 times out of 9 times when I went into the U.S., I would be, you know, hauled across and...
7 out of 9 under the Obama administration?
Under the Obama administration, yes.
Huh.
In a couple of the cases, I actually got profiled before boarding the plane to the U.S.
Really?
So
it was,
yeah, so because... Homeland Security, U.S. Homeland Security, has agents stationed in Europe. So this was at Heathrow.
Uh-huh.
You know, as I'm about to head onto the flight, you know, a very polite person steps up to me. Hello, sir. We're from U.S. Homeland Security. Do you mind answering a few questions? And you know, take me off to the side and you know, just you know, why are you going there?
What's your business?
All of that kind of stuff. And, it was exactly the same thing going into the country as well, you know.
And now?
Well, I've been there, 4 times during the Trump administration. And now each time I just kind of cruise through. In fact, the entire process right now just is almost 100% automated. You just you get off, take your passport, stick it into the reader. It gives you a little thing that says "ping." You're free to go through, and you pick up your bags and you go.
Yeah, I've look. I mean, this is anecdotal, so it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the case for everybody. But it is interesting from an experience point of view because they have made the whole process a lot simpler.
Yep.
And the queues are a lot shorter. And you have to be prepared, like, you know, when you travel anywhere, that at some point someone's going to search something or not. And if it happens to you, then you're just unlucky or lucky. But I don't think that they're necessarily targeting people. And this travel ban, as they call it, is to do with Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, North Korea, and Venezuela. And it's not a Muslim travel ban, because North Korea, you might have noticed, is in there, and Venezuela, countries from Europe, Africa, and Asia are being considered for the expanded order, which may affect us. Mr. Trump confirmed that more countries will be added. "You see what's going on in the world. Our country has to be safe," he told reporters at the World Economic Forum. Gave no further details on which countries would be targeted or how many. But he said they'll release that list very shortly.
I doubt it's going to be South Africa at any level. If you look in... I spoke to the U.S. Embassy people out here about this a couple of years ago. South Africa has one of the lowest rates of rejection for visa applications in the world. Hmm. So something like 5% of our applicants are rejected.
Okay.
Which, you know, compared to most countries, there's a trust factor in terms of people who are applying for U.S. visas from South Africans.
All right. Local politics. I spent a couple of minutes this morning telling Sia that it would be worth just having an open mind about Herman Mashaba and what he wants to do. Let's investigate it before we decry it and poo-poo it like
so. Well, the interesting thing is that Musi's not on board.
Musi is not on board, yes. Mm. So Herman Mashaba is aiming to attract the 11 million South Africans who didn't vote in the last national election, which is a very good place to start.
Yes.
So it said
it is a good place to start. But then I think, again, this was a conversation that we had last week, you know, where we were talking, Gareth, you were on a bit of a rant, actually, about the fact that people still insist on voting the ANC into power. And my point was that the real issue for me is not that people keep voting the ANC into power, but that no one has been able to sufficiently fire the imaginations of the masses of the electorate to persuade them to actually go out there and vote for someone else.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this might be it. Maybe it'll provide an opportunity for people to...
I'm keeping an open mind on it. Okay. But I don't know what's... certainly Herman has been continuing to his dubious flirtation with the EFF, and let's see where that goes.
Just on the issue of Vladimir Putin, I got a message here from somebody who... Let me give him credit. From Paul. Paul says... Referring to young people loving Putin, I was in a vehicle with some sub-30-year-olds. We drove past the Kremlin. When they pointed out the president's office, I said, "Oh, is that Putin's office?" And the one lady said, "That is President Putin to you." So, according to some of the Russians, it's the same stuff. You know, when, for example, people get upset that you don't refer to Cyril as being President Ramaphosa, except I don't think there's a lot of that going on here right at the moment. And then somebody else saying that Trump won't ban South Africans. He has too many working in his clubs in Florida, including my sister. Our work ethic is too valuable. That's from Niska.
There's a point there. I think that South African expats tend to really have an extremely good reputation wherever you find them, anywhere in the world.
Ace Magashule has said Eskom and South African Airways were important government entities that were essential to the country's economy. On Wednesday, he said the governing party's National Executive Committee had agreed that state-owned enterprises needed to be restructured so they were not a burden on the national fiscus. Oh, really? Magashule, addressing a post-NEC press briefing, said Eskom and SAA were important government entities. There should be a proper assessment of the public enterprise's strategic importance for the development agenda, and their mandate must be clear, costed and monitored consistently to ensure successful restructuring programs, he said.
Which is essentially the same gobbledygook that they trot out after almost every NEC meeting, is it not?
Yeah, and this again from someone who doesn't understand economics at any level. Stella and Dabeni Abrahams is in trouble because she supposedly used taxpayers' money to fund her wedding anniversary celebrations overseas last year. She denies this, saying, no, within the ministerial handbook, it says that we can have 2 trips a year with our spouse.
That is absolutely true, but at the same time, it's also a requirement that you get permission from the president and you need to show why it's necessary to take your spouse along.
She says it's a smear campaign against her and welcomed calls by the EFF for the matter to be investigated. Ooh, exciting times. Anything you want to comment on there?
No, but there's also the fact that Lindiwe Sisulu is in a bit of hot water because she's been apparently unprocedurally appointing advisors.
Yeah, and people that she knows and likes and giving them big, fat salaries.
Well, it's the unprocedural part. I've got no problem with people appointing people that they know and like as long as they follow procedure. And as long as it's open to public scrutiny and as long as, you know, the credentials are up for inspection and all of that kind of stuff.
The EFF are very good at smelling out an outrage issue and jumping on that bandwagon as quickly as they can, trying to subsume it as their issue. They've done this now with the case of a young man who was at Parktown Boys, who was drowned in an accident. And it's an ugly story, and nobody in the whole world would be on the side of anyone who wasn't sympathetic to this child and his family. It's an ugly, ugly thing to happen, but the EFF have seen that there is political capital to be gained here. They are now insisting on an investigation. They're trying to get fundraising. They want the school to be censured and all kinds of other things to happen.
There has to be a legal process that gets followed. Surely there's going to be an inquest. There is.
But my point is that politically, the EFF have seen a chance for them to gain some virtue points on social media.
Absolutely, there, and they'll continue to do that. But, you know, I've been reserving passing any judgment at all in terms of what actually went down in that scenario. It's a horrible situation for the parents, and you know, you send your kid to school, and you find out a couple of days later that and they only discover it a couple of days later. But again, as I said, I'm not going to be passing any opinion until such time as, you know, there are legal processes that take place.
There was a very interesting high school matric results paper that was put out on social media. I don't know whether or not it was real, but it had numbers like 27% for Zulu, 40% for English, 22% for life orientation, 11% for mathematical literacy, 17% for accounting, 36% for economics, and 24% for tourism, and this person passed. Do you believe this stuff, or do you think that it's just, again, social media nonsense? Oh,
I don't know. You know, I don't really care. You know, the whole question right now of whether a matric certificate in of itself is actually worth the paper it's printed on is, yeah. The truth of the matter is that if I look across the period of time that, and I'm sure many other people have this sense as well, when you interview people for positions and they've actually come out of university and they can't read, write, and count.
Yeah, that's very, very sad, because it means that you, no matter what's written on the paper, you realize very quickly that this is not a person who you can employ.
Exactly.
You can't train people from the ground up. And for tertiary education institutions, it's become a problem because they accept students based on a matric result or on a standard 9, what do they call it now, a grade 11 result, and then they take them in and realize after the fact that they're not literate and numerate and that they actually can't do the courses required.
Yes, but then instead of expelling them, which they should be doing, they still insist on pushing them through the production pipeline.
So it means that the whole system is then losing credibility.
Yes.
So what's the point of having a degree? What's the point of having a matric if it hasn't got any worth in the job market?
Well, even if you have a degree, and even if the degree is actually useful, you still need a booming economy that's going to create jobs before you can actually get employed.
Can you guys chat a little bit about the impeachment? And should this happen, what would the economic implications be? That's a question for us this morning on the line from Sean. Well, okay. Sean, he's technically already been impeached by the House, as Nancy Pelosi said in a very dramatic day the other day, last week sometime. This is an impeachment for life. He's one of four presidents now who've been impeached by the House. Of course, the trial is only just getting going in the Senate. The trial is where they will decide whether or not to actually remove him from office as a result of the impeachment. But the impeachment has gone through. It's gone through politically, which means that a majority of Congress people in the lower house, the House of Representatives in America, have already voted to impeach the president. That hasn't got any force in any other way other than politics. And unless the Senate decide, where the Senate is mostly Republican, the House is mostly Democrat, if the Senate do decide to actually enforce the impeachment and push him out of office, then there will be consequences. But otherwise, it's really just a footnote in history, right? Am I wrong?
Well, the more crucial thing about this is that you consider we're heading for a presidential election. And essentially what you're trying to do is to remove a president through undemocratic means ahead of an election. Now, given that we have an election coming up where the people of the United States are going to have the ability to decide whether or not they want this president around, why are you actually trying to bludgeon this into submission ahead of this, other than to actually try and cast a shadow over Trump ahead of the election? But I don't think that that's actually working. Another interesting thing, by the way, Gareth, I don't know if you picked this up, but Tulsi Gabbard has filed...
She's suing Hillary Clinton.
...for $50 million. For essentially defamation, and because Hillary Clinton accused her of being a Russian, what was the word that she used? I forget, but a Russian plant.
That's right. During an interview, all there in black and white. It could have very real repercussions for Hillary. We'll see.
Yes. And
she has a stinging opening paragraph in which she says, this is a woman who has always coveted the role of president, and now that I'm actually running, her bitterness has flowed over into calling me names. It's done damage to my reputation. I'm going to sue her.
Very much so. But I think what's also interesting is that you're now watching the spin coming out that's trying to steer people away from Bernie Sanders in the direction of Elizabeth Warren, given that, Biden seems to be, seriously floundering.
Yeah. Well, there's a great account that I've started following called The Babylon Bee, which is on all social media. It's worth following on Instagram and Twitter, certainly. The Babylon Bee saying, Democrats worried that if the impeachment fails, they'll have to nominate an electable candidate. So there's some of that going on, too. Yeah, they've really just got such, and of course Bernie and Elizabeth Warren turned on each other quite dramatically last week as well.
It was Elizabeth Warren that basically turned on Bernie. Look, as you know, I completely disagree with most of the stuff that Bernie believes in, but I certainly don't believe that he's acted dishonorably through this process.
No, I think he's been treated very unfairly by, among others, CNN.
Absolutely. And so the point at which Elizabeth Warren then takes a conversation that she might or might not have had with Bernie a couple of years ago and now presents it out of context to try and create the impression that Bernie is actually anti-women presidents is really scummy.
No, it's horrible. It's disingenuous. It's unkind. And for a guy like Bernie, who has been fairly consistent over the years, it just smacks of the sort of machinations that make Elizabeth Warren seem like an insincere person too. Just listen to this quickly. This is the actual audio after the last Democratic debate. When Elizabeth Warren went over, Bernie held out his hand for her to shake. She refused to shake it and then accused him of calling her a liar on TV. Listen to this. So you can see them talking to each other, and then later on, they break it down and they go into, this is what you can't hear.
I want to show this video that occurred at the end of the debate. You sort of ended up in the middle of this.
Tom Steyer is the guy who is talking to.
What was that like? What,
Anderson Cooper now.
What occurred there? It's already being talked about quite a lot.
Look, I was just going up to say good night.
So that's what Tom Steyer said. He thought it was very funny, but the actual audio from that interchange is not very nice. I mean, here's what supposedly went down when they spoke to each other. That's Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. So he holds out his hand. She walks over.
With applause still ringing at the end of the Democratic debate in Iowa last night, the simmering feud between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie
simmering
Sanders
feud.
Suddenly boiled over.
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
What?
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion, we'll have that discussion. You called me. You told me. All right, let's not do it now.
I don't want to get in the middle, but I just want to say hi, Bernie.
Yeah, good. Okay.
She walked away without a handshake after intentionally trying to de-escalate the fight earlier in the debate.
Bernie is my friend, and I am not here to try to fight with Bernie.
But Warren wanted to make a point that a woman can win the presidency. It was one of the most memorable lines of the night.
Look at the men on this stage. Collectively, they have lost 10 elections. The only people on this stage who have won every single election that they've been in are the women.
They were sparring over a comment Warren says Sanders made during a private meeting in 2018 that a woman couldn't win the White House. Sanders strongly denied ever making such an assertion.
As a matter of fact, I didn't say it. And I don't want to waste a whole lot of time on this because this is what Donald Trump and maybe some of the media want. Anybody knows me knows that it's incomprehensible that I would think that a woman could not be president of the United States.
In the moment, Warren disagreed, but waited more than an hour later, until after the debate, to accuse Sanders of calling her a liar.
It's very ugly of CNN to position things the way that they did because...
Well, but the fascinating thing is if you look in terms of the polling, and I'm just going through the numbers right now. So in terms of CNN's poll, Biden is polling 24%, Sanders 27%, Warren 14%. If you look in terms of the Monmouth poll, it's Biden 30%, Sanders 23%, Warren 14%. The Economist, YouGov, has Biden 28, Sanders 18, Warren 21. It kind of, you know, goes up and down. But what is certainly true is that Sanders is certainly giving them a run for their money. And given that he previously had the nomination stolen by Hillary Clinton, it'll be interesting to see whether they try to pull the same thing again.
Now, if Elizabeth Warren does drop out, which may or may not happen, do you think those votes would go to Bernie or do you think they'd go to Joe?
I think as things stand right now, Sanders, I think, has pretty much maxed out on his constituency. I think he has a particular constituency. But the useful thing is that if Warren drops out and... is the support that currently is going to Warren automatically going to go to Biden? I don't necessarily think so. I think that you're going to have a situation where people are just going to be uninspired and not actually go there, in which case the DNC is going to have no choice other than to put forward the name of Sanders.
And that would go how if he were the nominee?
It'll be interesting. I think that he'll certainly be able to give Trump a better run for his money than Hillary did, you know, simply because of the fact that Sanders has a very determined constituency.
But they're small and they're not the majority of the Democrats. They're,
absolutely right.
He's not a moderate. He's a left-winger.
Yes.
He's an avowed socialist. He has some very wacky ideas. Perhaps some of the Democrats would be scared away by that, the more moderate ones, and might even vote for Trump.
Well, I think that is probably in all likelihood what is actually going to happen. But I certainly do think that in terms of, coming up with a message that's now going to present an alternative to Trump.
Yeah.
What is Biden's message, really?
Yeah, it's just, you know me. Remember me from the Obama administration? Uncle Joe, inappropriately touching and whispering and kissing.
let's not go there.
You remember me? A guy who just speaks incoherently in large, large sentences that don't necessarily have to do with what I'm doing.
Well, he's alienated a significant chunk of the young population over the past week by going after gamers.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Stupid idea.
I know.
It was very bad.
You know, kind of wade into things that you know nothing about.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, there's lots to talk about, but we're out of time. So I'm afraid that is a wrap on the Burning Platform for this Thursday.
What were we supposed to talk about that we didn't? Sia, you didn't send out
around a lot.
Sia, you did not send out a running order this week.
He did.
He did?
Yeah. No, he sent me a running order.
Ah.
We spoke about ACE. We spoke about Stella. We spoke about the World Economic Forum. Oh, Judge President John Schlope, but we don't have time now.
We don't have time.
Nobody has time for John Schlope.
Well, I think certainly people in the Cape Bench do, but let's see how that plays itself out.
Okay, that's all we got for this week. Thank you very much. The Burning Platform brought to you by Nando's every week on a Thursday morning at 7 o'clock. If you didn't get all of it, you can always download the podcast. And please give us some feedback. We want to know what you think, what you want more of, what you'd like to hear. Let us know on 0797482090. Email me, gareth@cliffcentral.com for more. Thank you very much. See you on the Burning Platform next week.
CliffCentral.com